This is a reading from Richard Rose's Albigen Papers, the third paper, titled The Veil of Maya. Life after death. Man is more concerned with the problem or possibility of life after death than he is with the arguments about God. Yet man, being inclined to believe that which he wishes to believe and to understand problems in proportion to his understanding, is liable to settle for a wide range of solutions to the eternal enigma. If Christian theologists recognize the need to be more than human in their guesses about divine purposes, they settled for much less and made God to appear as a subhuman ogre in their conceptualization of a helpless life followed by a relentless hell. And while reincarnation may be more digestible than Christian finality, it still fails to answer all the questions, and it also bears symptoms of rationalization. For the poor and oppressed, there is a hope of a better day for themselves and indirect revenge upon the oppressors. For the superior or dominant class of people, there is hope for still better and greater experiences, and there is more security for them if the less fortunate majority is placated by a promising philosophy. Another strange belief is that of assumption. The outstanding cases are the stories of Elijah and Mary. Some refer to the raising to heaven of Elijah as being a translation, but today the word translation is used to designate a slower metamorphosis of body material. Elijah and Mary were supposedly lifted up suddenly. The Catholic Church, in a recent gesture of sensationalism and dogmatic derring-do, decided that the Mother of Christ was assumed physically into heaven and decided that all Catholics were required to believe it. This command came at a time when the Church and all Christendom were struggling with the trend of humanity toward materialism, pragmatism, and utilitarianism. It was a very bad time to pull a rabbit from the tiara. If Mary was assumed bodily into heaven, then the substance of heaven should be analyzed again. Is heaven a dimension or a place? Would not Mary's body be a bit of an impediment in a place where all other creatures arrive bodiless and possibly subject to laws of another dimension? Evidently, Jesus was able to come back and get his body, since the body disappeared from the grave and later reappeared on the road to Emmaus. This does not prove that Jesus escaped physically from the grave, but could imply that the spirit of Jesus was able to simulate a body and to discard the mask at will. To say that a personality has found a means to travel from one dimension to another and to be seen in both is not unreasonable, although it implies a special talent. The SRF movement claims that some of its masters were avatars who had the ability to come and go between the spiritual planes, and they were also reputed to have extensive creative ability. This brings us to the word illusion, for many believe this world to be one of illusion and that some liberated spirits are able to evoke the illusion at will. If a person entered another dimension with his body, he would either experience body changes that would replace the present body exigencies, and hence he would immediately become a different being than us, or he would have to take some of this physical dimension with him, food and sanitary facilities, and this might imply the need to take it all with them. The business of reassuming the body on Judgment Day cannot be comprehended even by a simple-minded cannibal. Would the man who ate Captain Cook and Mr. Cook travel through the eternity together like Siamese twins or with interlocking molecules? Another problem arises with the knowledge that some people die with disease wasted or crippled bodies. The aged and crippled are supposed to find only a healthy young body on Judgment Day. If religion can make this concession to those who see the evident unreasonableness or pointless possibility of rising from the grave exactly as they earned it, then it is possible that the whole idea of resurrection has merely been a concession made to the many constituents of the church who could not visualize any other type of survival. For those who think themselves to be advanced beyond such primitive dogmas of the early church and who still cannot bear the idea of leaving the body, there is a group who call themselves translationists. They believe that a very small percentage of humanity survives death by translating. This comes about by a progress in spiritual growth where the body with each year becomes less and less physical and perishable until it is really a different substance, immune to death as we know it, unhampered by the functional exigencies that we other clods experience. Translation theories bring to mind many spiritual evolution concepts, theories that involve either a change of being or a growth of awareness. The growth of awareness interpreted as a necessity for knowing the future dimension. There must be some reason for the many divergent beliefs, which is like saying there must be many type of spectacles for the diverse types of vision. And with this observation goes the perennial struggle to try to make everyone accept a uniformly stylized pair of lenses or to invent a superset of spectacles that would adjust any and all eyes to spiritual reality. The initial part of any investigated observation must necessarily involve the study of ways and means of observing. Sometimes it is through the critical eyes of others. Science would demand a personal witness of one who had returned from the grave if science would ever be persuaded to enter the search for life after death. It would, in fact, demand many witnesses. For this reason, many intellectuals or pseudo-intellectuals became involved in spiritualism. Some courted ridicule in the pursuit of what might be called first-hand information. They sought out mediums and organized societies for psychical research, and they were rewarded with adventures in a very dramatic study. Descriptions of post-mortem adventures in the Tibetan Book of the Dead are not too incongruous with Curtis's concepts regarding spiritual planes. We have learned, however, that we cannot learn from the vapid wraiths that come through the curtains of a medium's cabinet. The intelligence is as evasive as their tenuous ectoplasm. They utter euphemisms, platitudes, and encouragement, but any explanation of the nature of their being and of their surroundings is vague and indefinite. We hope to find evidence that the form of man would find continuation even if it were unproven. And to hear the voices of our departed friends tempts us to embrace spiritualism. However, the fuzziest minds will feel slighted when they talk to relatives who, instead of awakening into greater realms of death, seem to be less intelligent than when they were living and need to be prompted with every answer. An obscure and somewhat secret brotherhood of mystics gives a very interesting explanation for this lack of intelligence among ectoplasmic spirits. This brotherhood advises that there are beings who are able to imitate the form of the deceased. These beings may not necessarily be human, but are rather creatures of a different dimension. Whether or not they don the masks left behind by the astral body is not important here because it involves more tangential and conceptual thinking, not directly relevant. For those not experienced in spiritualistic terminology, the planes referred to are generally listed as seven, with the astral plane being the plane immediately above or next in experience to this plane. Many students of spiritualism are likewise acquainted with the concept of the astral body, a shell left behind on the astral plane when the spirit goes on to higher planes. In some writings, we find the word soul synonymous with the astral body, while the essence that survives the lower planes is known as the spirit. And, of course, other writings refer to the beings, supposedly on the astral plane, who haunt houses as being spirits and refer to the immortal essence as the soul. Such confusion results in painstaking definition by all parties on all points. The lay spiritualist is not aware that cabinet spirits are beings of another dimension. Western scientists did not suspect that such were beings. They suspected trickery. Spiritualism does not explain away or disprove the counter-concept that other dimensional entities manipulate the masks of the dead, or until it does, one theory shall be as good as another, and the foundation of spiritualism shall be in jeopardy. The unscientific teachers of India and Tibet are responsible for the first explanations of the counter-concept, or the idea that beings or entities could manipulate the ectoplasm. The always ultra-civilized Western world managed to kill off the witnesses to spiritual phenomena, so much so that some benevolent entities appeared as deceased saints hoping to protect the medium from ecclesiastical fire. William Cooks treated Katie King as a deceased person. Eliphas Levi was of the opinion that most spirits were somehow created out of the subtler essence of the medium's body, which the magus manipulated as he would theatrical wax. We cannot say that Levi was entirely wrong, for there is no way to be sure that some mediums do not have unique talents. The Rosicrucians believe that in some cases man is able to create such entities. If there is any conclusion that can be drawn from these concepts, it is that the medium's cabinet is not an infallible threshold or two-way glass door between the different dimensions. We can recognize that spiritualism and thaumaturgy are valuable means of gathering more information about such entities and their environment. Spiritualism has degrees of depth, as does any religion. The lower levels have to do with fraud beneath the pretense of being a comforting utility. And the messages that come from the mouths of genuine materializations are no more sagacious than those that are relayed to us through the clairaudient and clairvoyant mediums. When asked to describe heaven, God, Christ, or even the pastime of the deceased, all of the above sources reply in a sweet but inane manner that might be described as spiritual double talk. The matter of materialization is worthy of scientific investigation, both in that it is a phenomenon unexplained, in that it presents a situation in which a man seems to function as a creator. The pretense about supports is that they are creations. At one seance which I attended, the spirits wove a scarf and presented it to a grief-stricken but heavy contributor, a mother from eastern Ohio. There was emphasis here by the elated pseudo-medium that it was created, woven especially for this mother. Then if such weaving be possible, is it not possible that the phantoms themselves could likewise be manufactured? The more likely truth is that the scarf actually came from beneath a cheesecloth tunic and never had been anything but material cloth. The mention of phantom weaving is not mentioned here to expose a case of trickery, but to indicate inconsistency in a movement that would fail to see the full possibilities of such weaving. The significant thing to remember about spirit materializations is that regardless of their identity, they do not seem to have as much personality or intellect as the living person did, all of which would not be encouraging if we were hoping for mental evolution upward after death. Not that we should look for that which flatters our hopes. I have been privileged to witness several materializations that were not cheesecloth. The figures were recognized by relatives, but the control spirit's voice bore a remarkable likeness to the medium's voice, as did the voices of other emerging spirits. Most mediums admit that the spirits use their larynx, but never mention that the ectoplasm itself may well emerge from the medium's body. W.J. Crawford spent a lifetime studying spiritualism and table tilting and discovered that the table was moved by ectoplasmic rods or cantilevers that extended from the solar plexus of the medium to the approximate center and underside of the table. He established these conclusions with the use of a soft putty which is placed on the underside of the table. And he isolated the path of the invisible cantilevers by moving a square piece of cardboard beneath the table. When the cardboard interfered with the path of the cantilever, the table would fall back. His book, titled The Reality of Psychic Phenomena, is valuable to anyone interested in this type of research. Spiritualism exists all over the world, but under different names. The guides or spirits have different names as well, being demons, djinns, Petrus, and elementals. Eliphas Levi charts celestial domain and categorizes the host of angels and demons. It should be remembered that Levi did not deny the existence of entities or demons, but inferred that the wraiths that appeared as souls of the deceased were very probably ectoplasm only. His real name was Alphonse Constant, and it is presumed that he had adopted the pseudonym to stay alive. He had been a priest but left the church, married, and became quite an authority on magic. After many years of this research, he is supposed to have rejoined the Catholic Church with the comment that everyone should belong to some church in preparation for the next life. Evidently, if there is anything to gather from the life's work of this man, presuming it is true that he did rejoin the church, it is that his research gave him no greater promise than that offered by the church. Levi reminds us that his knowledge of entities came from studies by the church hierarchy, and this indicates that Levi either left the church to marry or that he was restricted in his search by being in the church. And all of this also indicates that at one time the church was searching for the truth before it degenerated into secularization and the apathy that comes from being afflicted with overweight. Levi, who lost faith in the church, based his entire structure of magic upon faith. He tells us that the apparition of Apollonius of Tyana may well have been created by his faith and consequently was not the soul of Apollonius, which his students would have liked to have seen. This is worth remembering when we encounter the analysis of faith in later chapters. And so we ponder the limitations of faith and the coloration that those limitations place upon the results, the creations of faith. Let us go now to cases which are known as spontaneous reappearances or resurrections of the dead, where it now seems possible that their testimony would appear more valid than the testimony of conjured spirits. It is impossible to review all of the cases of this type or to examine them for authenticity. If we are to presume that they have any value at all, we must admit that a percentage of them may well be sincere accounts. Occult magazines are well supplied with letters from readers attesting to this type of experience, and by occult magazines I do not pay for these letters. Articles written by doctors bear witness that some patients, on returning from states of unconsciousness peculiar to terminal patients, relate strange stories and experiences which cannot be blamed on drugs or delirium. We can study the many different reports and reach some common denominators on the evidence available. One factor noticed is the inconsistency with other accounts of after-death experiences. Another peculiarity that has been noticed in many medical cases reported is that the patient had no horror of death and often lamented at being revived. As regards variance in testimony, we have cases where a dying man saw his departed relatives but seemed unaware of celestial scenery or environment. Some noticed beautiful landscapes but saw no relatives. We have accounts where exotic environment is witnessed, in which appear strange vistas, colonnades, iridescent geometric figures, and many other phenomena. A very few have mentioned hearing exquisite music. The nose seems to have no place in heaven. I do not know of a single report of a fragrance. Some have reported a dimensional world subject to the wishes of the viewer. and these are rare. All of which brings us back to the concept that man may well have, in a limited fashion, the power to project or create. Man may color that which he sees with that which he has already seen, desired, or contemplated. Or he may project a picture of his expectancies upon the matrix of mind or next plane substance with an intensity similar to projections on a theater screen, so that it causes an illusion that there is a living movie screen life, when actually the only life is behind the audience, us, in the projector, God. This is similarly maintained, but rendered in other words in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Some spiritualists believe in a desire world or plane, a realm wherein the spirit can create any illusion by simply desiring. This could also be hell. And of course, the whole concept may be the result of the testimony of resuscitated persons who manifestly were rewarded with objects of desire while in the dream or death state. A significant factor that should not be overlooked is the attitudinal evidence presented by people who are dying. Medical reports show that a majority of people who know that they are dying relax and show no anxiety. This may or may not be evidence that euthanasia is part of the physiological and psychological progression of terminating creatures. It is also possible that the computer found a sudden comprehensive answer thrust upon itself and was delighted in the accident. We move on to another type of personal witness, and that is the unexpected or spontaneous appearance of spirits. This type involves neither invocation nor medium. Typical cases would be the haunts of old houses, roads, or scenes of tragedy. Such cases include solitary spirits, armies of soldier spirits seen by a living army, and convocations of monks. If their substance is ectoplasm, and ectoplasm is somehow dependent on human energy, then the visible shells of this type of spirit must have drawn from the residual energy left behind by people visiting the spot, or, as in the case of the phantom army, drawn from those present. There are also accounts of people who have been accosted and warned by spirits that resemble themselves, the observers. We have often heard of people who claim to have seen their double. The so-called experts have laid this type of phenomenon on the door of the astral double or astral body. The significant thing about all of these spirit witnesses is that they show little sympathy for the monumentousness of man's ignorance and the monumentousness of any information that might be extended by someone who could understand and would, once having lived in this ignorance, know that the living yearned for this knowledge. Yet, what do we get? The spontaneous appearances or reappearances, while ranking as the most informative, if not authentic, still is largely a visitation of warning. This means that the deceased are interested yet in the affairs of this dimension and either cannot or will not place the wisdom of the next dimension above the need to warn us of an accident pending or approaching death. Science, of course, would prefer the conjured type of spirit since this would be a controlled experiment, but the conjured type of spirit rarely shows the intelligence or awareness that might be associated with a being that is supposed to be sitting astraddle two dimensions. What conclusions can we draw except that man is frustrated by what appears to be a direct blocking by supervisory powers or simply by the stupidity of the millions of seekers? We come now to the group of theorists who accept the destructibility of the body and believe that the soul rises either to eternal paradise or descends to hell. They borrow from one another and, while borrowing, protest that the party from whom they borrowed is spurious. So that while we move from one group to another, we can observe several things. We find the common denominator of all seekers to be ignorance. And from this overlapping confusion among cults and religions, we find that most conventional movements have similarities, and we find a common denominator in them in that they are all offered with ingestible syrup. The seeker's problem lies in knowing how and when to step with courage out of the isms which our computer or intuition indicates as being inadequate for other than a social emollient. In studying and cataloging isms that cling to the one life, one death idea, we find that there is considerable variance among them. Some do not believe in hell and vary in their idea of heaven. Each heaven is colored with wishful thinking, and sometimes we find a spiteful heaven wherein only the adherents of a particular exponents are allowed. The interpenetration of different beliefs has a significance. We may not be as unique as we are led to believe. Christianity was built up an elaborate theology and mythology that can find no origin in the teachings of Christ. Christianity and the religion of ancient Egypt are similar. The Egyptians, several thousand years prior to the time of Christ, believed in a heaven and an underworld. They believed in the human soul and in an ethical or moral code that would facilitate their meeting with God face to face. Osiris, like Christ, was a man who gave his life to improve the lot of his fellow man and to secure immortality for them. There was a Judas in his camp that betrayed him, and there is mention of 72 followers. It is suggested that the Copts, or early Egyptian Christians, played a big part in adding a few trimmings to the teachings of Christ. Some numerologists and occultists believe that the entire story of Christ is a fabrication or translation of Egyptian names into Hebrew names, which would be more palatable to the Eastern Mediterraneans. For them, the occultists, the word Mary means Egypt from which emanated truth. In Egypt, they believed a fellow called Apep, a double for our devil. In the Book of the Dead, Egyptian, a common vignette shows the deceased person speaking to the serpent Apep. That's A-A-P-E-P. The Christians also connect the snake with their devil. The different houses of Osiris remind us the limbo and purgatory of the Catholic Church. There is considerable similarity between Catholicism and the religion of Osiris and less proportionate borrowings by the Catholic Church from Asian religions, so that it might appear that geography and communication had some effect on the ramification of Christian theology. The mummies of Egypt and the bodies in the catacombs show no alarming deviation from the idea of universal salvation. In Egypt, the poor people were cremated or buried, but they had a belief in rising again, and it is not clear from the translation of the Book of the Dead whether they intended to return to the same or another body. Nor is it clear today why the Christians are so abhorrent of cremation, or why the Catholics go through the exhausting ritual of blessing and anointing corpses, or of blessing graves to ensure a celestial expedition. Lamentation goes up for the soul of the deceased who is not buried on sacred ground. And yet the laity meekly accept the explanation that God bends down with special dispensation for the faithful who were incinerated at the stake or digested by the lions in a pagan arena. And are not these martyrs accepted as saints today, and are they not saints in heaven? Incidentally, in both Egyptian and Christian religions, there is a belief in a final day of judgment. This implies that heaven is somehow subject to time for these theologians. Death is not an eternal now, nor is heaven an eternal now, but is measured by the years it will take for souls to live sun-measured lives up to a certain point in that solar system, and then to be gathered, the ancients and the modern souls, for a massive trial. We come now to reincarnation. It permeates Asian religions mostly. It can, however, be found like a whisper or hint in parts of the Bible. Christ's admonition to Nicodemus concerning the origin of flesh and spirit is one example. John the Baptist is claimed by some to be the reincarnation of one of the older Bible personalities. The insistence that Christ will come again in physical form is noted. We deal with a new type of divine justice, and this makes the theory of reincarnation unique. The earthly sojourns replace purgatories and limbos, and man is not damned for his ignorance, but is required to work the lessons over again. Spiritual evolution is tied to the earth, and life becomes more of a classroom than a torture chamber. The weakness in the theory of reincarnation lies in the inability of the layman to understand the objective of perhaps millions of years of transmigration. In other words, where are we aimed and what is the reason for the whole system? The presumption is that if we knew, we might employ some of this so-called free will to accelerate the growth. Another weakness in the theory of reincarnation is the failure of the believer to remember past lives. Of course, the authorities maintain that this ignorance is a prerequisite for our spiritual growth and maintain that if we knew that which was in store for us, we might try to throw our machine into reverse. We come now to the school of thought which has very little connection with the foregoing isms and which has for its objective the union with the absolute. There are many terms eternally vague to the layman, such as cosmic consciousness, nirvana, samadhi, satori, awakening, and enlightenment. The implications of these strange words, while being vague descriptions of an indescribable state of being, also point to a change of being for the aspirant, admitting possibly the need of the finite mind to adjust to the infinite before pretending to understand it. Among the so-called masters who claim to know about those states of mind, there is much contradiction. The words so-called are not to be interpreted as being derogatory, but denote the uncertainty of the title of master. There is no way to distinguish a master from a neophyte, and if the reader knew the difference, he would not need to read this. Buddha once was asked by a candidate neophyte to prove his claim of being a master by proving to the candidate that the latter would actually reach nirvana by following Buddha's path. Gautama, the Buddha, replied that the candidate was unreasonable in demanding an answer to an impossible question. It would be like demanding proof from someone describing a long journey or distant scenery. The only proof would be to go and see for oneself. So the main weakness in this category is the intangibility of the concepts concerned and the impossibility of checking the people who claim to be masters or authorities. In this category, we are not dealing so much with religion as we are with direct experience. We are dealing with systems that have no readily accessible temples, if temples exist at all. These systems depend very little on written directives and are so diversified in form as to confuse anyone not simply drawn as by a magnet to a particular school. And there is much refutation of authority within some systems. For instance, P.D. Uspensky devoted much of his adult life to the investigation of methods for the expansion of consciousness. He was a disciple of Gurdjieff, a very mysterious and autocratic spiritual master. Yet Uspensky, while never denouncing Gurdjieff nor attempting to discredit him, nevertheless dissociated him with him and founded his own school. And his books lead me to believe that Uspensky had the better system. Gautama founded the movement now called Buddhism, yet the yogic masters who admit Buddhist origins or affiliations and some Zen masters claim that what is now apparent on the face of the earth as Buddhism bears little less resemblance to the original message of Buddha than Christianity bears to the true message of Christ. According to one Zen master, who from report must remain anonymous and may consequently not be personally attacked as false nor hailed as true, Buddha really started Zen, and Buddhism became a personality cult depending for substance on the parables and wise sayings. The number of people who were really endowed with the teaching of Gautama initiated were few and tremendously out of proportion to the vast number of Zen Buddhist monks who might lay claim to cognizance of the system. This same man claimed that there was a lineage of any true master that could be traced back to Gautama. This tracing is, of course, not possible. If there were no records kept, then we must take people's words for these things. A man may claim that he was initiated by another now dead, but unless the dead man has left a bona fide proof for this for posterity, we are out of luck. The category of union with the Absolute lays claim to being a transcendency over the previous religions discussed. This makes it unique. The weaknesses that mark the doctrines of various religions are not to be found in it. The wheel of incarnation, reincarnation, if aimed at nirvana, may have more meaning, but an endless wheel of reincarnation could make lemmings out of humans. Cyanide would be better to live with in the knowledge that man can never escape from the misery of eternity being reborn into the pain of adjustment to nature, only to be extinguished each time by nature. But heaven and hell, as dreamed and depicted by Dante, Milton, and Swedenborg, would have to be consigned to the realm of illusion. They would exist in somewhat the same intensity as the light projected upon a theater screen that seems to be animated by the projector. Thus we become not the potted, but the potter. We become possibly the projector, but the projections, our physical bodies included, may no longer be considered as any more real than the projections. So away goes the grave, Sheol, hell, and heaven, and with them the peddlers of fear pills. And what do we have? Still there is confusion. We have first no clear knowledge of the state of being implied when any of the words such as cosmic consciousness, nirvana, samadhi, or satority is heard. There are different schools and approaches. The direct approach method is called Zen. Nothing about Zen makes sense unless you have become a Zen adept. Then there is the evolutionary approach to the union that may take many years or incarnations. This is found in some yogic groups. Here we have an overlapping of dogmatic beliefs with ideas of change of being. Personal immanence is shadowed by concept building. Some reincarnationists believe that reincarnation leads to a state of nirvana after a long period of evolution through incarnations. Some believe also in a longer period of evolution on a spiritual plane after the body is finally discarded. Thus, the theosophist Blavatsky speaks of Buddha as being on a level slightly above the level of the masters Kuthumi, Maurya, or Christ. And the implication from this form of yoga is that these levels are somehow related to duration or time as reckoned in the solar system because of the periods of service needed to earn the step of a master and the service time needed to earn still later the step of a bodhisattva. This type of Buddhism is a very laborious climb if union with the Absolute is going to be achieved inside of a million years. There is much confusion, evidently, between the Absolute state and that which might be called the universal mind, a plane which still may be a projection. Yogic schools that protest their ability to reach the Absolute still compile volumes about phenomenon produced and miraculous ability over the course of matter. Yet, is not he who is able to mold the wax or reform the matrix of matter still only a mechanic, dealing with material by his own admission, and consequently dealing with illusion by his own admission? Blavatsky has two ponderous volumes filled with the wonders of phenomena down through the ages, with miracles ascribed to occult groups, all offered as incentive for the reader to become a theosophist. But from her accounts, heaven is not an absolute state, but an endless ascension of spirits to nobler and nobler heights. We are dazzled with timekeeping in yugas and make the entire life of mankind on earth a very small point in the overall time during which the great spirits were building the cosmos. The progress in time that it might take for an amoeba to become a bodhisattva may be possibly computed. And that is not all. Somewhere are many masters and Buddhas gone before of even greater spiritual heights, but nowhere is there an end in sight, so that we begin to wonder again about the purpose of spirituality. Also, in the SRF movement highlighted in America by Yogananda, we have an evolution toward becoming a master or avatar. Yet we must ask about the extent to which this adroitness as a master might contribute to our state of being. Babuji, or Babaji, which incidentally only means dear one, was always popping up in crowds in India so that one of the disciples of the movement might tell of the alarming event. Babaji also performed sensational feats, but only for the elect. There is a story told about a party of sorts which was given for one of the chief adepts, in which an entire palace, villa, or village was materialized for the occasion, and if memory is correct in this matter, an immense amount of gold was materialized. Would not such a new religion bring the poor peasants of India on the run? In America, no group has contributed more to the researching mind about religions of India and Tibet than the Theosophists. Where, in some of the Indian cults that have invaded America, there is uncertainty, there is a dynamism and a strong appeal to human reason on the part of the Theosophists. Besides, whatever conclusions we may reach about them, they have provided humanity with an invaluable service. They have stimulated curiosity about the origin of things and about the nature of man, and they have laboriously compiled information to exercise the scientific mind. And if there is one who might be considered a voice or authority about theosophy, it must be Blavatsky. Theosophy would incorporate all religions, echoing Max Müller with the claim that all spring from the same hunger and all are aimed at the truth, despite the fact that some along the way become neither sectarian, venal, or are limited to the understanding of the devotees. Theosophy does not deny Christ. It enlists him and places him in a harmonious relation to theosophy. Theosophy's attempts at a marriage of the utterly profane with the utterly abstract philosophies is interesting to note. That Blavatsky decrees the understanding of the Absolute to be the basic reality can be found in the proem of the Secret Doctrine on the 15th and 16th pages. She likens it to the Parabrahman of the Vedantists, inferring that they have a similar concept. Displaying an unusual familiarity with the relation of man to the Absolute, she goes on to describe it as the causeless cause from which first emanates the Logos, and from the Logos comes the next emanation, life, and finally intelligence. There is considerable confusion to be found by cross-checking the writings of Blavatsky. Here we are concerned with the confusion that exists in heaven, or at least Blavatsky's heaven. She also speaks of a war in heaven. The first cause, or the Logos, should not have too many meanings. Anything that is first, absolutely, should not have more than one meaning. At different places in the Secret Doctrine, Christ is supposed to be the Logos. Jesus, if there is a significant difference, was supposed to manifest the Logos in himself as being the Son of the Logos. On page 232 of Book 2 of the Secret Doctrine, he is described as an initiate, a savior, and a parallel of Krishna. In Book 1, page 264, Jesus, or Joshua, is referred to as representing the fall of spirit into matter so that the war in heaven is only allegorical. In Book 2, page 231, footnote, we find that Jesus and the Father are meant to mean soul and spirit. The Logos is not a spirit, as we noted earlier, but the first cause, antedating spirit, or Purusha. In works other than the Secret Doctrine, Jesus is looked upon differently. Blavatsky places him on the master level with Kudumi. In Isis Unveiled, much space is used to discredit Jesus. In book 2, page 201, Jesus is described as a wise adept of the Rabbi Elhanan, who traveled into Egypt, studied the Kabbalah, and was later hanged upon the cross. This according to the Talmud. On page 566, book 2 of the same Isis, Christ is not the Son of God, but only a high priest. Here goes the Logos out the window. On page 574 of the same book, Professor Mueller is supposed to prove that Paul was the real founder of Christianity and not Jesus. For Paul, Christ is not a person, but an embodied idea. End quote. Page 239 undertakes to find that Jesus or Christ was a man and only a man. So much for the compilation of confusion. If, by running between the raindrops or by treasure hunting in confetti, we are supposed to find the truth, then Blavatsky may have some system. The vital issue is time. How much time do we have to fumble with the variegations of symbolism? Is there not a simpler way? If man is to become united with the Absolute in a million years, there is no value in the present contemplation of sacred writings or histories of erroneous and incomplete movements. In summarizing the various approaches to union with the Absolute, we first encounter the slow evolutionary theory. Secondly, we have groups of people or cults that endeavor simply to expand consciousness and whose ultimate aim is cosmic consciousness. Gurdjieff and Uspensky may well come into this category. Thirdly, we have the direct method system, which is Zen. The Zen method is supposed to be quicker and supposedly brings the individual into maximum enlightenment. We might also mention another group which expect to join the Absolute in a state of unawareness by becoming obliviated and returning to the electrical field of the cosmos. We cannot discuss any of these groups without participation if we expect to do them justice. And with the teachers who would lead us into expanded being, there is no argumentation or reasoning. In Zen, reasoning would only be used by the master to run your intellect up a rat hole. We are left, therefore, with either an emotional magnetism towards such teaching, or else we are selected by virtue of intuition. If we need to look for a reason for embracing schools of either expanded consciousness or of Zen. And even after the student has embarked upon one of the two paths mentioned, at every stage along the way, he still finds himself unable to translate intellectually that which is happening to him.